Palestinian resistance groups vow that Israel will pay a heavy price for its crimes after its strikes on Gaza leave over a dozen people dead. Iranian president emphasized all those involved in U.S. assassination of top Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commander must be brought to justice. And Saudi Arabia and Syria say that they're going to reopen diplomatic missions in their respective capitals after over a decade of tense relations. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to World News. The Israeli forces conduct another airstrike on the Gaza Strip, killing two Palestinians in a vehicle. Regime says there were Islamic Jihad members preparing a missile attack on Israel. Separately, Israeli helicopters attacked a naval base in Gaza operated by the Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. This amid heightened tensions in the wake of Israel's surprise aerial strikes earlier in the day, which claimed the lives of 13 Palestinians. People in Gaza have held a funeral for those victims. Three senior members of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement, along with 10 other members, including all family, were killed. Four of them were children. Deaths bring over 120 number of Palestinians killed so far this year by Israeli regime and settlers. Meanwhile, the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement has vowed to avenge the deaths of three of its senior members in Israel's strikes on Gaza.
As we celebrate the martyrdom of our great leaders that confronted the enemies along the years and their wives and children, and our brave Palestinian people who were killed with them, we confirm that this sinful crime will only increase our faith in God and accept His fate and persistent in the path that the martyrs had taken, the path that will end with the defeat of the enemy.
Abu Shahab, another Islamic Jihad spokesman, says regime must expect a response at any moment, anywhere. He said resistance now considers all Israeli cities and settlements legitimate targets. Hamas chief Ismail Haniyeh also vowed regime will pay a price for the attack. He said the assassination of resistance leaders will not bring security to the regime, but instead more acts of resistance by Palestinians. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassem also warned Israeli regime over its latest atrocity in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli occupation committed a great crime and treacherous aggression against our people in the Gaza Strip by bombing residential areas and homes, which led to the killing of children and women and targeted the leaders of the resistance. Our people and the resistance know how to respond to this great crime and make the occupation pay the price for this aggression on the Gaza Strip.
Palestinian resistance group Lion's Den also warned Tel Aviv of surprise and unprecedented retaliatory attacks. Group warned time is running out and gates of hell will open to the regime in the occupied West Bank. Meanwhile, Palestinian foreign ministries call for international mediation to stop Israeli strikes on Gaza. The joint command of resistance groups, that's an umbrella group comprising Palestinian armed factions in Gaza, also said the regime should be prepared to pay a price for the attack.
Israeli warplanes carried out a series of airstrikes at Pride on Tuesday, which resulted in the death of three high-profile military commanders of the Islamic Jihad movement, Tariq Izzeddin, Khalil al-Bahdini, and Jihad al-Ghanim. The Ministry of Health confirmed the death of 13 Palestinians altogether, including women and children, among them the wives and children of the Islamic Jihad commanders. 20 others were also injured, some of them in serious condition. The Israeli airstrikes, which targeted the middle of the Gaza City and Rafah and Khan Yunis in the southern of the coastal enclave, caused a great destruction of the residential apartment buildings as well.
I was asleep, and suddenly the explosion broke out and the rubble fell on us. My granddaughter was asleep by my side. We both woke up, not able to see anything from the destruction.
The Israeli occupation has a record in killing Palestinian civilians, children and women. Today, Maya Ezzedin and Haja al-Bahtani, two Palestinian girls, the daughters of the Islamic Jihad leaders, fell victim to the Israeli attacks, like the other thousands of innocent children that were killed before.
Palestinian resistance movements have mourned the martyrs and the family members and condemned the Israeli assassination. In several statements released, they have warned the Israeli occupying regime of the scale and the scope of the Palestinian response to the crime.
The Israeli assassination of the Al-Quds Brigade's commanders is going to cost the Israeli occupation a heavy price. It is a legitimate right to fight the Israeli occupation, and it's the resistance's duty to defend the Palestinian people against any Israeli aggression.
The heinous atrocity of the Israeli occupation that resulted in the assassination of three senior leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement and other civilians will see the Palestinian resistance factions unite in their crushing response as usual. We have the right to resist the Israeli occupation as it continues to commit war crimes against our people.
Thousands of Palestinians carried the bodies of the martyrs from the hospital to the Grand Al-Umari Mosque and then to the final destination to bury them in the northern Gaza Strip. Thousands of Palestinians took to the streets to express their anger over the Israeli crime that resulted in the death of innocent women and children. Palestinians are now calling for retaliation. The Palestinian resistance factions are now preparing for a crushing response to the Israeli attack and the assassination of the Islamic Jihad commanders, affirming their unity against the regime. Ula Al-Asi, Gaza.
Tel Aviv has warned settlers living near Gaza to stay close to bomb shelters in the coming hours over concerns of retaliatory rocket attacks from the besieged enclave. Israeli armies ordered the closures of schools, beaches, and highways in southern Israel and limited public gatherings. Armies also calling up military reservists. Israel's military affairs minister says regime should be prepared for a prolonged campaign. Regimes impose a total lockdown on Gaza, which has already been blockaded for years. Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu says regime is prepared for any scenario after Tuesday's strikes on Gaza. Israeli Foreign Minister Eli Cohen says he will return early from his visit to India. The representative of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement in Iran, Nasser Abu Sharif, says all resistance factions will unite and the Israeli regime will receive a crushing response for his heinous crime.
This is not only a crime against those who have struggled against occupation and have fought it, but it is also against innocent women and children, and therefore this is a heinous crime. This is a massive crime against innocent people, against humanity, against all our people, and therefore this requires that there be a retaliation which is to the level of this massacre. There will be a united retaliation and a comprehensive retaliation. The retaliation will be from all the factions, the resistance factions in Palestine. We have seen this. We have heard it from all the leaders and the commanders and spokespersons from the factions. And we have even seen this also by the coordination room, by the various political Palestinian resistance factions. And Hezbollah has said that they support this and they continue to support, especially the coordination room among the factions of resistance in Palestine.
And condemnations are pouring in over recent pre-dawn strikes by the Israeli regime that left over a dozen Palestinians dead. Regional countries have declared solidarity with grieving Palestinians. Iran's foreign ministry says attacks show the regime's weakness in the face of growing resistance. It stressed the Israeli regime needs to be held accountable and pay a price. Syria also offered condolences, vowing Damascus will continue to support Palestinians and their cause, call for action to put an end to Israeli bloodshed. In Lebanon, Hezbollah stressed the martyrdom of resistance commanders will only make the nation more determined to continue the path of resistance. Hezbollah called the cowardice massacre of innocent women and children a crime against humanity. Also, Jordanian Foreign Ministry urged the international community to prevent the Israeli regime from committing such crimes. Iran's president says serving justice in the case of the assassination of Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror commanders should not be time-barred. Ebrahim Raisi was speaking in a meeting with the visiting president of the Supreme Judicial Council of Iraq, Faiz Zaidan. He's referring to the assassination of former commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and his companions in Iraq more than 3 years ago. Deputy commander of Iraq's popular mobilization units, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was also killed in the drone attack ordered by then-U.S. President Donald Trump. Raisi said Iran is aware of the determination of the Iraqi government and judiciary to follow up on the case and bring all those involved to justice. Saudi Arabia and Syria are to reopen diplomatic missions in respective capitals, that after a decade of tense ties between the two countries. The Saudi Foreign Ministry said diplomats are set to resume work in Damascus. Riyadh says it's seeking to develop a joint Arab action. Syria has also announced a similar decision following a Saudi Foreign Minister statement. This 2 days after the Arab League welcomed Syria back to the pan-Arab bloc after more than a 12-year suspension. Now, over the past months, many regional countries have restarted relations with Damascus. Those countries had severed ties in the wake of foreign-backed militancy in Syria back in 2011. Violent protests have erupted in Pakistan following the arrest of ex-Prime Minister Imran Khan over allegations of corruption. Our correspondent Nasir Kazmi reports out of Islamabad.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife's name. The money should have been deposited in the National Treasury, but went into a property which was registered under a trust.
Following the arrest, thousands of Khan's supporters took to the streets across Pakistan to protest their leader's detention. Clashes between police and protesters were also reported in all major cities and towns of the country.
The arrest of the former Pakistani Prime Minister has further fueled the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
Russia celebrates May 9, 1945, which marks the end of the most atrocious and bloody war in its history, or in history. For the former USSR, numbers of lost lives are in the range of about 27 million. To mark the sacrifice, memorial ceremonies were held in most Russian cities. Marina Kortanova reports from Moscow.
On May 9th, Russia commemorates the capitulation of Nazi Germany to the Soviet Union and the 27 million Soviet soldiers and civilians killed in the World War II, known in Russia as the Great Patriotic War. This year, the victory parade on Red Square in the heart of Russian capital Moscow was held without the usual aerial maneuvers and with a minimum of equipment. With the latest military developments in the Ukraine war, fighter jets, tanks and missile defense systems were partly showed, as they are needed today at the front line. In his Victory Day speech, President Vladimir Putin said that the real war is once again unleashed against Russia, but the country will ensure its security and protect the inhabitants of Donbas.
Boundless ambition, arrogance and impunity inevitably lead to tragedies. This is the reason for the catastrophe the Ukrainian people are going through. They have become hostage to the coup d'etat and the resulting criminal regime of its Western masters, collateral damage in the implementation of the cruel and self-serving plans.
Vladimir Putin also criticized the demolition of monuments to Soviet soldiers and said the West is creating a Nazi cult. The president pointed out that the desecration of a generation of victors is a crime.
It is a crime, an outright revanchism on the part of those who were cynically and blatantly preparing a new march on Russia and who brought together neo-Nazis come from around the world for this. Their goal, and there is nothing new about it, is to break apart and destroy our country, to make null and void the outcomes of World War II, to completely break down the system of global security and international law, to chalk off any sovereign centers of development.
At 14, I became a partisan, then an infantryman machine gunner. This is our victory, and we have won this memory. We see the depressing example of Europe. I want to say that Russians will never forget this day and will always remember it. Here, it will always be honored.
I'm from Makeyevka, from Donbas. My entire mining family has perished since 2014. Only one son remained. And today, I've come here in Moscow to pay my debt to all the defenders, the soldiers of our past and present.
Unlike last year, the Russian president did not announce new measures to support the participants in the special military operation, but noted the leaders of the CIS countries who came to celebrate Victory Day in Moscow. Together with Putin, the leaders of Armenia, Belarus, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan watched the parade on Red Square.
For millions of Russians, May the 9th is a lot more than a national celebration. Today, Russians celebrate their victory over the Nazis in 1945. The Russians are one of the last who celebrate this holiday officially, remember which side were the heroes, and at what cost the Soviets got this victory. Marina Kartanova, Moscow.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is He who has sent His apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that He may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد اینها چیزایی لازم است
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
In the limelight.
WHO's Director General has recently said the COVID-19 pandemic has been on a downward trend, but the risk of new variants remain. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote in this regard, the World Health Organization WHO announced recently that COVID-19 is no longer a public health emergency of international concern, or PHEIC. WHO's Director General Tedros Adhanom made the decision following a recommendation by the organization's COVID-19 Emergency Committee. During a meeting, the committee highlighted the decreasing trend in deaths and hospitalizations and the high levels of population immunity against SARS-CoV-2 as reasons for ending the PHEIC. During a press conference the following day, Tedros emphasized that COVID-19 remains a global health threat and said that the new status doesn't mean that countries should let down their guard. It's time for countries to transition from emergency mode to managing COVID-19 alongside other infectious diseases, he said. The announcement didn't come as a surprise. After the emergency committee's last meeting in late January, Tedros acknowledged that the pandemic was probably at a transition point. This is not a snap decision. It is a decision that has been considered carefully for some time, planned for, and made on the basis of a careful analysis of the data, he said during the press conference. A PHEIC defined by the WHO as an extraordinary event that constitutes a public health risk to other countries through the international spread of disease is the highest level of international public health alarm. The COVID-19 PHEIC was declared on January 30, 2020. In practice, this decision compelled countries to start reporting cases to the WHO to create worldwide surveillance. Importantly, it's signaling to all countries that they need to prepare for it, says epidemiologist Salim Abdul-Karim, the director of the Center for the AIDS Program of Research in South Africa in Durban. In the 3 years, 3 months, and 5 days that have passed since the PHEIC was first established, countries reported 7 million deaths to the WHO. Estimates from the WHO and others as to the pandemic's true death toll are 2 to 3 times higher. There are no hard and fast rules to determine when a PHEIC is over, says Karim, adding, we are still very much in a pandemic. We are just in a different stage in which we are no longer seeing large numbers of deaths and pressure on hospitals. He added, for Karim, the end of PHEIC is a recognition that SARS-CoV-2 will be around for a long time. But although he says the decision was pragmatic and reasonable, he worries that it will mean in terms of resources and availability of diagnostic tests, vaccination, and treatment. Epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo, the director of the Pandemic Center at the Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, says it is unclear whether this decision will have much practical impact, given that many countries have already been relaxing their measures to combat COVID-19. Nuzzo says political attention to the pandemic was lost long before the decision, unfortunately. Even while COVID remains a top cause of death, governments have decided to put their energies elsewhere. Nuzzo says it's important to distinguish between the end of the PHEIC and the decision by individual countries to end their public health emergencies. The United States, for example, announced that its COVID-19 health emergency will end on May 11th. That means U.S. residents will lose access to free COVID-19 testing, vaccines, and treatment. Karim says, so it will worsen the inequity in the access to diagnostics, treatments, and then that's my concern. In his statement, Tedros said he also decided to establish a review committee to develop long-term recommendations for countries on how to manage COVID-19 going forward. The WHO published an updated version of their Strategic Preparedness and Response Plan for COVID-19, outlining actions that countries should take in the next 2 years. Nuzzo says what is most urgent now is to make sure that countries don't turn back on trying to learn the lessons of COVID and bolster their preparedness for future pandemics. In the meantime, according to Science, Greg Gonzalez, a public health expert at the Yale School of Public Health, says he's less concerned about what to call the pandemic than what is done to address it. Regardless of whether it is called a PHEIC, COVID-19 continues to cause death and suffering across the globe, he says, adding, yet almost everywhere we've declared mission accomplished and we have no appetite for doing anything more to fight this disease. Gonzalez says we are willing to bake in a huge amount of morbidity and mortality to get back to normal, and it doesn't bode well for facing our future.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers for today's discussion, Brother Ali Alevian and Brother Suhail Sarani. Brother Suhail, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'm Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me here.
So, Brother Mahmoud, the producer of this program, dedicated this new series of the program, Viewpoints, in the whole month of Ramadan to the topic which is rarely discussed, we can say, in the academic fields and also Islamic fields, and that is the book Nahjul Balagha and the significance of this book as tackled by the leader of Iran on different occasions and his different speeches. The beautiful point about Nahjul Balagha, one of the greatest part, is the letter that he wrote to Malik al-Ashtar, which was going to be sent as the commander or the, we can say, governor of Egypt on that time. This letter has been referred to as the text in which we can find today's, we can say, human rights movement. Mm. You know, the thing that today the people are looking all across the world. And this is not the words of the Shias or the Muslims, but non-Muslim has said this about the Imam Ali alayhi salam's words and sayings, especially in that letter, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because we have so many human rights movements, so many human rights organizations nowadays that are looking for a charter for their works and guidelines. I've seen different codes and different, we can say, books have written on this specific letter by non-Muslims. For example, George Jordak has wrote,
and
we can say this,
it's beautiful
about
that he himself actually warns us in Nahjul Balagha, mm-hmm, and tells us that beware, that do not let Islam to be understood and to be actually to be implemented by others than Muslims.
Than Muslims.
But we see that this Christian brother and this scholar, this
George
Christian
Jordan.
Scholar, George Jordan, this Christian scholar, he confesses that he read Nahjul Balagha more than 200 times.
Yes.
You see, and we, as the follower of Imam, or let's say as Muslims,
yes,
how many times have we ever read this book and actually found this affection towards Nahjul Balagha? And I think even the nature of Nahjul Balagha is in a way that, in case you start reading it,
mm-hmm,
you will find the beauty of it and you cannot detach from it very easily.
That's right.
I wish that Muslims
benefit
got back to this great treasury that they have at hand and they don't know, mm-hmm, the value of it.
Okay, Brother Suhail, what's your opinion on this part, brother, that Nahjul Balagha itself, we can say, is not that much given significance in today's world among the Muslims themselves? And most of the Muslims all across the world, we can say, on different schools of thought, are not even familiar with this book, we can say, on the sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Is it so?
Very true, and sadly, it's very pity. It's a precious gem, as one of the precious gems, as Brother Ali mentioned. And, when you think about it, it's like, suppose you have a rehbar or the leader of Muslim Ummah coming to your city. Would you not go for listening to his speech? Of course, you rush for that. Now, we are talking about Imam Ali alayhi salam. And then we are sure that these are the speeches of Imam Ali himself. Right? So, how much attention should we have towards this? And how much importance should we give to these speeches of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the letters and, the sayings of him? So, but it's all about, as brother mentioned, it's like a nuskhe or prescription from the doctor, which is lying without, you know, unfolding the even paper. Like, we are not even unfolding the paper to see what's inside, unfortunately. But the emphasis has been is being put by the ulama, by the scholar. And inshallah, as leader mentions, we should, you know, at first step, even he mentioned that, you know, somebody without understanding Nahjul Balagha, you know, if you can claim that, you know, I understand Quran, it's not that true, the true claim, because Nahjul Balagha in one interpretation of him is Nahjul Balagha is nothing but the sequence of Quran, or you know, the tali of Quran is the same in Farsi.
Okay.
You know, the following of Quran. So that's how important it is, and we should definitely pay more attention to it.
That's all right. And the true position of this book, you know, the case of interpretation and the case of commentators and interpreters of the Nahjul Balagha are really important, because, you know, when you look at the text of Nahjul Balagha, some parts are really hard to understand. I mean, because the wording, especially on the sermons, on some of the sermons, needs interpretation itself.
Definitely.
It is very true that we can say these words have been said by a person who has tackled these issues from a very high position regarding spirituality. So it knows its own interpretations, its own courses on the universities and the houses. And this is, we can say, what they have done about great scholars and great books in the Western world. They have held different courses of universities and the houses on a specific, we can say, scientist or book, and discussed it. There are some specific people and scholars in the world whose only interest are working on a specific person or scientist or a scholar during the history of the Western philosophy, for example. But what we did about Nahjul Balagha, did we do this exactly? There are some people who have wrote sharh on that, or there are some organizations on that. But in order to make it more applicable in the daily lives of the people, I think the role of the interpreters and the scholars are important here. Isn't it, Brother Ali?
We have not worked a lot on this precious book, and we have not actually started decoding the importance of this book. The book, which is with us now, actually, as I said, it was left obsolete in the course of history, and it was not used as is what it's supposed to do. As for the interpretation of it, it's interesting to know that one of the important interpretations and commentaries on Nahjul Balagha has been done by a Sunni brother, Ibn Abil Hadid, who was a great Sunni scholar. Alhamdulillah, recently, there have been actually some new works on Nahjul Balagha and its interpretation. But it's really sad to say that they are not to the level that it deserves to be. So that's why it has not been worked on, though it has variety of topics and subjects in it, and that it can actually cover different areas and arenas that are of need of today's human life. It has issues, it has actually topics about the lifestyle of the human being, what is actually a sort of affliction of human being in our today's life, that they are in need of knowing how to live. These are the points that are needed. And at the same, they are said, these things, these words, these sermons, these wasings have been said by a leader, a person who was in the leadership of the Islamic society, and at least he was a potential, if he was not superficially in power, but he was actually a person who had the claim of being a leader of the Islamic Ummah and has been appointed by the Prophet of Islam. Anyhow, at least some years of his holy life, he was in the position of the leadership of the Islamic society. So when we say that he had a set of comprehensive subjects presented to us, and it's our time to get benefit and to get you and collect the knowledge that we need from this precious book. We see in this book topics about moralities, about our world, our dunya, and also our hereafter. Whatever we need to know as a human being in this life, whatever we have read or recited in Quran, is actually complemented by Nahj al-Balagha.
That's all right. They say it is a compendium to the Holy Quran. We have these great books. Also, Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya is really missed, you know, in the world.
In comparison to Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, yeah. Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, actually the mission of actually that book was different, because it was mostly around the dua, and through dua, Imam tried to teach people whatever he wanted. But he see clearly in every science, in every actually branch of knowledge, when you want, Imam actually enters professionally and teaches you very directly, because Imam did not have those cautious that actually Imam Sajjad had at his time.
That's
he
right.
was the leader, and Imam Sajjad unfortunately did not have this opportunity to be openly talking to people and disclosely talk to people. But Imam Alhamdulillah had this chance to say whatever he wanted.
That's right. Thank you much, Brother Ali. Brother Sohail, what's your final remarks on this?
Well, Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya, I would like to say, even as Brother mentioned, because of the time of Imam Sajjad alayhi wasalam, it makes it different than Nahj al-Balagha. And all in all, the time of Imam Ali was actually the, you can say, is the peak time of Islamic glory, right? And one of the peakest time of Islamic glory. And Imam Ali was as the first person of the Islamic government during that time. He was the leader. And most of the sermons and most of the letters were given by him during that time. So he had an encompassing view over all the affairs of human society, starting from individual life to the social life, and you know, from various dimensions. So that's one thing that makes it Nahj al-Balagha different than any other book.
That's right.
But still, Imam Khamenei mentions his, in one of his speeches that if you get tawfiq, you know, if you get that inner inspiration from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then after doing some research and research work on Nahj al-Balagha and learning from that, you can start with Sahifat al-Sajjadiyya as well.
That's right.
Because that's another book which is not being given that importance which is due for it.
Okay, thank you very much, Brother Sohail and Brother Ali Al-Avian, for your presence in the program Viewpoints, which was on the topic Nahj al-Balagha, as discussed by the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Dear listeners, visit our website at parstudio.com/Call of Islam Radio. Also, our YouTube channel, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the limelight.
The British Bureau of Statistics announced a significant increase in the unemployment rate, which shows the first effects of the economic recession following the energy crisis and the sharp increase in the cost of living in Britain. Unemployment in the United Kingdom has risen dramatically, and the government is now looking for new sources of income and spending that can curb this trend. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. The official figures showed the UK unemployment rate has edged up unexpectedly, highlighting a faster-than-expected spike in wage rises in the face of skyrocketing inflation across the country. According to the figures presented by the Office for National Statistics, ONS, on Tuesday, Britain's job vacancies have fallen for the ninth straight month, in a sign that the uncertain economic outlook is heavily impacting the British job market. The data revealed that the unemployment rate also rose to 3.8% in the 3 months to February, the highest level since the second quarter of 2022, while vacancies fell by another 47,000 in the first 3 months of 2023. The increase in the unemployment rate appeared as a surprise for the government, as most economists had expected the rate to remain unchanged. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said firms continue to cite economic pressure as a factor in holding back on recruitment, as they can't afford employees' wages. Meanwhile, total pay, including bonuses, grew at an annual rate of 5.9% in the 3 months to February. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, regular pay, excluding bonuses, also continued to rise by 6.6%, but down by 3.4% with Consumer Prices Index inflation taken into account. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee is watching wage growth carefully for signs that inflation is remaining stubborn and may consider raising interest rates once again in May in the light of recent figures. Martin Beck, the chief economist advisor at EY Item Club, said, given the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee's wariness around inflation's persistence, February's strong rise in private sector regular pay could easily shift the majority in a more hawkish direction. Ellie Henderson at Investec Economics added, we think that on balance, the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England will raise the bank rate by 25 basis points to 4.5%, but that will be the last hike in this tightening cycle. Eddie Henderson added, today's data release arguably supports that call. The labour market is still tight, suggesting a further tightening of the screws. The economic pressure and the cost of living crisis have prompted many workers across different industries to hold industrial action now and then, causing disruption in services in different sectors such as Royal Mail, British Rail, National Health Service, the NHS. Junior doctors are the latest group to strike, seeking a 35% pay rise to compensate for below-inflation pay rises over more than a decade. According to the Office for National Statistics, ONS, discontent over pay in the public sector saw 348,000 working days lost to strikes in February, up from 210,000 in January. It has been worried that pay growth to match inflation only raises the already surging prices. A cost-of-living crisis driven by sharp food and energy price increases has left the British people struggling to pay their bills. The Conservative government argues that pay increases would increase inflation, which currently stands at 10.4%. The British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered this story and tells us more. The fallout from the wave of strikes was underlined on Tuesday, 18th of April, with figures showing nearly 350,000 working days were lost in February. The number of days lost due to industrial action was up to 348,000 from 210,000 the previous months, with almost three-fifths down to the education sector. The number of stoppages hit 654, the highest ever recorded by the Office for National Statistics, with 250,000 workers involved. Just under 1.4 million days have been eradicated since December, a month when the level reached 826,000. Strikes have been taking place across the National Health Service, Education, the Civil Service, and Rail, as workers demanded higher pay amid the cost of living crisis. The Office for National Statistics data show that the highest number of stoppages in a previous month was 530 back in 1970. The figure appears to have been pushed up because school strikes are counted as separate disputes between staff and their direct employer, which can be academies or the local authority. The stark numbers were revealed in statistics showing the jobs market defying the economic slowdown, but real-term wages are still tumbling and long-term sickness has hit a new record. Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, claimed unemployment is still close to historic lows, despite official figures showing the rate nudging up from 3.7% to 3.8% in the 3 months to February. Pay continues to be outstripped by surging inflation, with total wages, including bonuses, up 5.9%, but down by 4.1% when headline Consumer Prices Index CPI is taken into account. Worryingly for the Bank of England, which is trying to keep a lid on prices, regular private sector wages were increasing faster than expected at 6.9%. British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The real value of UK workers' pay continued to fall at the fastest rate for more than a decade, as wage increases in February were outstripped by high inflation. The Office for National Statistics, ONS, said annual growth in average pay, excluding bonuses, held steady at 6.6% in the 3 months to February, despite a small rise in unemployment and decline in the number of job vacancies. Fueled by bumper pay for bankers and accountants in the City of London, wage growth, including bonuses, rose by 5.9%. Economists had forecast weaker rates of pay growth in a potential dilemma for the Bank of England as it considers whether to raise interest rates for a 12th consecutive time in May. However, the Office for National Statistics said total pay fell by 4.1% on the year after taking inflation into account, among the largest falls since 2009. Reflecting softer conditions in the jobs market as Britain's economy struggles for growth momentum, the unemployment rate unexpectedly rose to 3.8%. The number of job vacancies also fell for the ninth consecutive month, although remained high at more than 1.1 million as companies struggle to recruit staff. The Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, said, "While unemployment remains close to historic lows, rising prices continue to eat into paychecks, which is why halving the inflation rate this year is one of our top economic priorities." Average wage growth in the public sector picked up to 5.3% on the year, the fastest annual rate since 2005, although continued to lag behind wage growth of 6.9% in the private sector. Paul Novak, the Trades Union Council General Secretary, said the figures showed workers were suffering the longest wage slump in modern history. Calling on ministers to resolve pay disputes, Paul Novak said, "Hard-pressed families can't take much more. It is no surprise that workers are having to take strike action to defend their standard of living."
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.